Welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. 60 million years ago, an asteroid some 7 miles across slammed into the Earth, leaving a geologic wound over 50 miles in diameter. More than half of known species, including the dinosaurs, vanished seemingly overnight. In the last days of the dinosaurs, science writer Riley Black takes us through what happened in the days, years, centuries, and million years after the impact, tracking the sweeping disruptions that set the stage for the world as we know it now. Today we talk with Riley about how the worst single day in the history of life on Earth was as critical for us as it was for the dinosaurs, creating space for mammals to seize the evolutionary opportunities that were closed for the previous 100 million years. Riley, welcome to Locus Focus.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Yeah, I heard you on Science Friday a few weeks ago, and I was very inspired not only to read your book, but then to talk to you. So I'm very glad that you're here.
Of course. I mean, I've loved dinosaurs since I was a kid, so really any excuse to talk fossils is a good one for me.
Well, as I was going on, I was thinking about the news of last week, and people may be wondering why, after the overthrow of Roe v. Wade and the incredible revelations that were revealed Thursday in the January 6 hearings, why are we talking about dinosaurs today?
You know, that's been on my mind pretty constantly as well. And part of the reason that I wrote this book is that it's not so much about loss as resilience, that this was really a story of how life comes back, even from some of the worst possible catastrophes. And in some ways, that feels somewhat like cold comfort, because obviously, like, this is not an asteroid impact. This is something that people did that could have been avoided. But I've found a lot of meaning in thinking back to those creatures that survived, that lived on the margins, that lived underground, found some way to survive, even thrive, build something new from the remains of what once was. And, you know, even if the metaphor doesn't entirely track in scientific terms, if we go too far into the details, it's still, I think, a very important story about how life finds a way, even under the most extreme circumstances.
As I was reading your book, it took me back to the 8-year-old that I was when I became totally absorbed in dinosaurs. Kind of, I think you were probably about the same age. However, I went on to other things, and it was very inspiring reading your book to see that you never went on, or so to speak, that you really have followed your passion for dinosaurs for the next, 30-odd years. So I was wondering, what inspired you to stay so absorbed by dinosaurs?
There's something that I just love about wondering about prehistoric life, about the curiosity of it. I remember being 5 and going to the American Museum of Natural History in New York City. And this was before the big renovation. So the halls back then, they were relatively dark and they're really moody. And you'd look at these bones like shining under the museum lights. And I would wonder about, how did this animal move? What did it sound like? Even just like the sound of its breathing, what did that sound like, looking at a brontosaurus skeleton? And all those things are still there, whether I'm in the field or I'm reading something about a new paper, I'm just thinking about what life was like back then. So much relies on our imagination, that these are things that are real and were part of our natural reality and tell us so much about the past and our planet, but they require like our engagement, our curiosity to kind of bring them to life. It requires that we bring something to them in a sense to get them to live again. They can't just be observed running around as much as we might wish for that sometimes. So it never really left. I love that it feels like it's a science that's very close to the curiosity that we have when we're kids. And I think that's why it appeals to so many kids. And like you said, I never really grew out of that. I didn't want to just know the data or just know all the names. I wanted to think about, okay, what is this animal really like back when it was around? And how does what I think intersect with what we're learning?
Well, how did you come up with some of the visuals and audio of the dinosaurs that you describe? It's almost a little bit anthropomorphic in a way that you describe each one of these critters, whether it's the dinosaurs or the survivors after the impact. But I wonder, particularly with the dinosaurs, how you got a sense of the sounds, and if you trust the description that you gave of the ways that these different dinosaurs would not just move, but actually make sounds.
That's right. So in the back of the book, I have an appendix where I try and lay out like all the different choices that I made and why. And there are certain things that I am most likely going to be wrong about in the future. But then again, if you look at the history of science and the history of dinosaurs, our image of what they were and what they were like has changed so much. So that's always true. Like, we always have to take that little bit of risk to do it. The process that I took was really based a lot about my own experiences in nature. So in the first chapter, when we meet this T-Rex that's about to dine on this Triceratops carcass and is going to open it up so all these other little scavengers can, you know, get a piece and all the sounds they're making, how they're squabbling with each other. That's based upon observations I made in Yellowstone National Park of a bison that died near the road. And there was a grizzly bear and a gray wolf that were both feeding on it, with all these birds hanging around the margins waiting to get like a little piece of it. So I tried to think of all these little connections between organisms and how they move. And some of it relies on just like headspace. Like some of the best research I did for this was not so much through books or papers, but like I would just sit in my office chair or on the futon in the corner of the office and think about, okay, if I were a T-Rex or if I were an Edmontosaurus and I'm in ancient Montana and I'm moving around and I'm hungry, what am I going to do? What does that look like? What does that interaction mean? What are the movements involved? Are there other dinosaurs around me? Is it relatively open? So this was really like almost an exploration of, you know, internal like headspace, really trying to like, you know, bridge that gap of 66 million years and think, what would it be like to be a dinosaur? So it's very personal in that sense, but I tried to anchor it to science, what we know about living things today, as much as I possibly could.
Where I live, we have a lot of great blue heron in the neighborhood, and they make this incredible squawking sound when they take off. And my partner has often said they sound like dinosaurs. And do you think there's any validity to that kind of connection?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, birds are living dinosaurs, and that's one of the wonderful things about them. They were the one group of dinosaurs that survived, or at least most of them did. And looking at birds now and what they do and what they sound like can give us some great clues about what non-avian dinosaurs did. Now, modern birds, many of them have certain vocal organs that most non-avian dinosaurs didn't have. So dinosaurs like T-Rex and Triceratops and Ankylosaurus, all those favorites. But we can also look at other living relatives. We can look at things like crocodiles and alligators. They're very noisy creatures. And there are all sorts of lizards and other reptiles like snakes that make noise by rubbing their scales together or splashing in the water or hissing or whatever it is. So there are these threads that, even though it's been 66 million years since this impact, and it's been 245 million years since the first dinosaurs evolved, that we can look at organisms living today and still get some idea of what it must have been like to be a dinosaur back in their heyday.
Well, one of the things that really puzzled me, maybe even bothered me when I was a kid learning about dinosaurs, was that they went extinct, the way that they went extinct. And, of course, that was back in the 50s, and we really didn't know what happened and why the dinosaurs went extinct. And there were all kinds of theories back then. But I wonder how much that the extinction of the dinosaurs has played a role in making them so kind of magical to us and so mysterious and so dramatic.
Absolutely. I mean, that's something that Deep Time does that I feel like we don't reflect on often enough, how there's this gulf of time that makes dinosaurs more mysterious. And it really alters our view of what life is and even our relationship to it. I mean, the fact, for example, just to shift to, you know, closer to our own lineage for a minute, there used to be many, many different human species, like six or more present on the planet at the same time. And we are the last one left. Part of the reason that we think that we're so special and so different is because all of our closest relatives are extinct from over the past 6 million years. And when we use that same kind of logic, when we're thinking about things like dinosaurs, part of the reason they're so wonderful and we're so curious about them is because they're so unlike anything alive today. And we can't see it, that we have to do the sleuthing and go to the bones and go to the tracks and all the other forms of evidence and pull something back. Whereas, like, if they were still here, if we had, you know, co-evolved with them and things like Triceratops are still wandering around the street, you know, they might seem annoying or pretty everyday or pretty mundane. So it's, you know, that length of time definitely makes things seem a little bit more curious, a little bit more exotic in a certain way. It feels like it's a different world, even though it was our planet.
When I was a kid, I got even then as a young person that the dinosaurs had lived a lot longer before they went extinct than human beings have been on this planet. And I wonder what that tells us about ourselves and our own perspective on time and on extinction.
Yeah, and it's also relative, right? In that, like, our human species, Homo sapiens, has only been around for about 300,000 years. The group that we belong to called hominins is only about six. But one of the things that, like, really fascinated me as I was researching the book and writing about this was, like, our earliest primate ancestors, if you want to pick that group, which is getting towards like as big a group of, as dinosaurs were. The first primates evolved about 68 million years ago, same time as T-Rex. So the first primates, the earliest members of our family, were there and survived that mass extinction. And we're here partially because of them and because of their survival, that, you know, our ancestors didn't just pop up in the aftermath, that they were there, they were present, and they made it through. And that this story isn't just about sort of like this Lawson's clearing away of, you know, the age of dinosaurs so that mammals could thrive. It's very much intertwined with ours in this sort of bittersweet moment where we want to see dinosaurs alive. But if they had survived, if they hadn't been decimated the way that they were, we almost certainly wouldn't have existed. And there's not a great word for it. It's something that is both happy and sad at the same time.
When we first learned about dinosaurs as kids and we learned that they went extinct, I didn't know at the time that that was not the first extinction. It turned out it was the fifth extinction. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to talk a little bit about this whole cycle of extinctions that has happened to life on this planet. Then we can talk in more detail about the great extinction that took out the dinosaurs and 80% of the rest of life on Earth.
Certainly, yes. The one that ended the Cretaceous, that was the fifth mass extinction, or at least the one that's most commonly recognized as being the fifth. So there are quite a few of these biological crises that life has been through.
The one that I learned about much more recently than when I was in second grade was the Permian extinction, which was really dramatic. And that's the one that I started measuring the current extinction we are probably in and the dinosaurs extinction. So let's talk a little bit what that was and compare that to what happened with the extinction at the end of the Cretaceous.
Sure. So the mass extinction that you're talking about happened around 251 million years ago. This is just a little bit before dinosaurs first appear. And it's at the end of what's called the Permian period and just before the Triassic, so the first chapter of the Age of Dinosaurs. And in the Permian, the most prominent animals on land, like if you were to visit it, the animals that you'd most likely see are actually some of our close relatives, the proto-mammals. So even though that we used to call them mammal-like reptiles, they're actually much more related to us. So things like if you've seen Dimetrodon, that kind of lizard-looking thing with the sail on its back, that's actually much closer to mammals than it is to reptiles. So it was animals like that. And there's this incredible amount of volcanic activity that occurred in Asia around that time, to the degree that, and this wasn't like lava spouting into the sky, this is like flood basalt. So just like the Earth is like separating, it's oozing magma all over the place, pouring greenhouse gases into the air. The oxygen content of the air itself is dropped. The world becomes a lot hotter quickly because of all those greenhouse gases. The oceans acidify. You know, more than 75% of known species, up to perhaps 90% of species that we know of in the oceans that were around at the time, disappear and go extinct. This is like as close as life really came to having the reset button pressed for almost everything. And it was really that mass extinction that there are very few proto-mammals that survived, but reptiles got their shot in the aftermath. This is what really allowed the age of reptiles and of dinosaurs in particular to evolve. So in a sense that, you know, even though, and we'll get to it in a moment, you know, the age of dinosaurs ended in the mass extinction, they only existed because the mass extinction sort of cleared the field ahead of their evolution about 252 million years ago. And you see very quickly in the aftermath, within about 5 million years, which is still a very long time, granted, but relatively speaking, it's fast, all these different reptile groups, because you not only get dinosaurs, you get the flying pterosaurs, you have the ancestors of marine reptiles like plesiosaurs and ichthyosaurs in the oceans, and all these weird sorts of creatures that, like, you know, sort of pop up and fizzle out relatively quickly. So it was this huge shift in that, you know, life had kind of been building in this particular way for tens of millions of years. And then all of a sudden, that's almost entirely wiped out. And the reptiles come to the fore in the aftermath.
Well, you're listening to Lucas Focus on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Oregon. Seattle stations KBFG, LPFM, and KODX, LPFM. KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, Oregon. KCEI in Taos, New Mexico. Radio Free Moscow in Idaho. And Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with science writer Riley Black, who's author of The Last Days of the Dinosaurs. Well, before we get on to the next great extinction, one of the thoughts I have, and maybe why the Permian has interested me so much in the last 10 or 15 years, is because it is another example of runaway greenhouse gases. And that's pretty much what put out life as we know, as they knew it at that time. Is that correct?
That's right. Yes, that was one of the major causes, you know, this rapid shift. This intense warming that followed from all the greenhouse gas poured into the atmosphere. And there have been other times that some of the things that have occurred, they're not always tied to extinction, but paleontologists often study events like these. There's another one that happened after the Cretaceous extinction called the Paleocene-Eocene thermal maximum, this huge heat spike that happened because of various greenhouse gas emissions that got into the atmosphere, you know, naturally at that time. And it caused this warming spike, and life responded in a particular way. So we often look to these events, not just as history, but to get an idea, like under these conditions, when you change the atmosphere in this way, when you change the oxygen content in the air, you acidify the oceans, what happens? How does life respond? And to give us like an idea of like, okay, where should we be focusing our efforts, knowing that things are now coming, you know, in our near future, where should we put our priorities? How do we triage this for life on Earth?
Well, one of the things that I was very interested in a number of years ago when I learned that that asteroid that crashed in the Yucatan Peninsula back 66 million years ago, that was the culprit that killed the dinosaurs. And it was a really different story than what we had been thinking about and considering. And one of the differences that actually really became apparent in your book was how sudden it was and how sudden the shift was. I want to talk about the difference between that extinction and all the previous ones and what we might experience as the sixth extinction if we don't watch ourselves.
That's right. And that the extinction that happened at the end of the Cretaceous, it was incredibly sudden. None of the other mass extinctions were quite like it. All the previous four were caused by what we might term like terrestrial causes. So it was changes in oxygen levels, or it was intense volcanic activity quite often, and the consequences of those particular eruptions. So it was all things that were kind of self-contained to our planet. This is the only time that we had a massive asteroid, you know, strike the planet and cause a mass extinction. And there's a great paper that I based, you know, at least the framework of this book upon after I read it, called Survival in the First Hours of the Cenozoic. So at the time period, like directly after the age of dinosaurs. And in that first day, you had all this debris that was thrown up into the atmosphere by the impact. So all this pulverized rock and little spheres of glass and shocked quartz and things like that thrown up into the air, they're spreading all over the planet. And as they come back down, they're generating friction. So basically this heat pulse that raised air temperatures to about 500 degrees Fahrenheit. So that's enough to basically set forests, like dry forests, on fire. So forest fires are spontaneously breaking out as a result of this. There's no way to survive this unless you can find shelter, unless you can get under the soil or under the water. It doesn't take a whole lot. It's really only a few inches of soil or water to mitigate this kind of heat. If you can get underground, but most, you know, big dinosaurs can't do that. Many forms of life couldn't do it. They weren't prepared for this. They didn't evolve to handle this. So really, unless you're a little mammal, like, you know, 4 inches or more underground, or you're a fish in a lake or something like that, there was no way to get around it. And rather than being something that played out over the course of hundreds of thousands of years, or maybe a million years, like some of these earlier mass extinctions, this happened basically between day one and then maybe 3 years later when the impact winter, when this global chill that followed the impact stopped. So that's really a blink of an eye, especially compared to what's happening now. You know, 10 million years or so from now, if, you know, there are beings around looking at our fossil record of this present time, they're probably going to see like the Ice Age extinctions where you lost the mastodons and the saber-toothed cats and things like that coincident with what's happening now. It's going to look very rapid when really it's taking, you know, thousands of years for this to play out. So, you know, even compared to our present moment, the end of the age of dinosaurs was incredibly quick.
A lot of us have this image, I think, of the end of the dinosaurs from Walt Disney's Fantasia, where the dinosaurs are just dragging along. And it doesn't really explain. It looks like the world dried out and there's cracks and the dinosaurs are dragging along and they're dying of thirst and they collapse on the ground. And then the earthquakes and the volcanoes start. So there was some accuracy, because there were volcanoes, right, that happened kind of simultaneously with the impact of the asteroid. But the dinosaurs dying of thirst over a period of look like maybe months or years was probably not very close to reality.
That's right. So that was back in an age where, like, we didn't know what caused this mass extinction, that the idea that there could be a mass extinction was still a relatively new idea. You know, it wasn't really fully accepted that we had these what's called the Big Five mass extinctions until about the 1970s, and Fantasia obviously precedes that. So, but there had to be a reason why, you know, the non-avian dinosaurs weren't around anymore. And through the 20th century, there are all sorts of different ideas. Some paleontologists thought that there are like these vital sources of like life inside organisms that like told a species, you know, when it was going to generate a new one or when it was going to perish. So sort of how like we have our individual lifetimers, that was also on the species scale, and that dinosaurs had just ran out or they got too big and extravagant to survive, or mammals ate their eggs or the climate got too hot or it got too cold. Some of my favorite ones had to do with people totally outside of paleontology, like trying to kind of help the discipline, but it really didn't help at all. There's somebody who wrote a paper saying it was caterpillars. It was hungry, hungry caterpillars eating all the vegetation. So the herbivorous dinosaurs died, then the carnivorous dinosaurs died, not, you know, realizing that like this doesn't explain the mass extinction that happened in the ocean. You know, caterpillars didn't cause this global mass extinction, even if it made sense in the scenario they were proposing. So it really wasn't until 1980 with the first paper on this impact hypothesis that the conversation started to shift and the evidence started to accumulate. And I think really it's even been the past like 10 years or so that impact has become the consensus, because we had these other forces. And even as we threw out some of the more outlandish ones, you're right, and there's these volcanic eruptions called the Deccan Traps in prehistoric India, back when it was an island, that were pretty massive. And because volcanoes caused extinctions before, we thought it might have done so at the end of the Cretaceous. It turns out that it was the opposite, that the volcanic eruptions actually spewed out enough greenhouse gas to warm the atmosphere by a few degrees. So during the impact winter that the asteroid caused, it might have allowed species to survive that otherwise would freeze to death. So that this is the one case in which like massive volcanic eruptions actually helped life on Earth. So we're still learning like the nuts and bolts of what actually transpired. But the idea that like it was the impact as the main cause is still relatively recent.
What's the evidence that they're used to believe that now the impact of the asteroid was really the cause?
So there are multiple lines of evidence. This is something that, you know, we not only have the impact crater, there are, you know, this famous KPG boundary, this clay-filled layer that you find all over the planet, you know, from Montana to New Zealand, that's full of basically a metal called iridium that's relatively rare in the Earth's rocks, but you find a lot in either the outpourings of volcanic eruptions or in asteroids and meteorites and things like that. And this is tied directly, like the impact is just at the right time. It's in the right place. There's been a lot of modeling done on like, okay, if you have a 7 mile wide chunk of rock hit the planet at this speed, at this angle, kind of reverse engineering what would have transpired. And it hits this particular form of rock that's full of these sulfur-based compounds that contribute to global cooling over time once they get out there. It really is the only explanation so far that seems to check all the boxes of how this extinction transpired, that fits all the various evidence that we have, that something catastrophic and very quick happened, whereas the various other explanations in the past, you know, like if we point to global climate change being, you know, making it hotter or cooler, well, dinosaurs have survived that for a long time. And they've survived, you know, all these millions of years of continental drift and all these other terrestrial causes without any hiccups whatsoever. And it really took something exceptional to do it. And it seems that, you know, whatever new evidence that we're getting, the case for impact gets stronger, that this was really like something that had never happened before in the history of life on Earth.
By the way, what does KPG stand for?
So KPG stands for Cretaceous Paleogene. We use K because C, which is the actual letter Cretaceous starts with, is already used for another time period called Carboniferous. It's much older. And PG stands in for Paleogene. So it used to be KT, but there's a lot of shifting around that happens in geological disciplines. We're often, you know, revising dates about when something happened or what the proper terminology was. So it was, you know, really about the, you know, beginning of the 21st century that KPG became the preferred term for that boundary layer that separates the end of the age of dinosaurs and the beginning of the age of mammal.
You describe at the end of your book that you go visit a place where you can see that line. I wanted to have you describe what that meant and what it felt like to see that line.
Yeah, I traveled to a place in Trinidad, Colorado. And it's kind of funny, if you use the old term, if you put in KT boundary in Google Maps, it will show up immediately. It'll give you directions for how to drive there. So this is a place where like I knew I could easily get to this boundary, and I felt like it was important to visit it. I didn't really expect there to be necessarily a great epiphany or something else, but like it felt strange to write about this event that I've been thinking about, you know, since I was a kid and learning about professionally for a number of years now, and not go to see it, not go to touch it. I felt like it was important for the context of it. So my girlfriend and I and our dog, we, you know, drove the, you know, basically like 10 hours to get there, to take this quarter mile hike, to see it, and just to sit with it for a moment, to realize that this was one of Earth's great inflection points, that history had been unfolding in a particular way, that life on Earth was evolving and doing what it always had and surviving and changing, and that all of a sudden, basically in an instant, that was all wiped away. And the pathways that opened up from that were entirely different. So it was like visiting almost like some like a monument to this global event that really allowed me and all of us to exist, but also, you know, was an event of great violence. It was a catastrophe, truly. And just to sort of sit with that for a minute, to sit with like with that feeling and think about what does this mean for, you know, why any of us are here right now, and the context that that brings when we look into the past, and understanding that I think for me, this stuff doesn't make me feel hopeless or alone or small. It really gives me a sense of wonder. It's like, it is amazing that we are here at all. So we might as well make it good while we are. And I think that's the most powerful thing I got from that trip.
Again, going back to when I was a kid, the only thing I knew that it was extinguished during the KPG extinction was the dinosaurs. When did we start learning that it wasn't just the dinosaurs that were being impacted by this major extinction?
I think it was what's called the paleobiological revolution that happened in the 1970s. And this is something that really was reliant on computing power, that you had these paleontologists who they would come up with these big binders, these big books of all the different fossils that are found in particular regions and what particular ages, and you could start to create databases of those, and you could start to analyze that data and say, okay, when does the species occur globally? When does it disappear? And you could do that at the family level and kind of track the expansion and contraction of all these different groups over time that were almost impossible to do if you had to just write it out on paper. And it was that kind of big data analysis of the fossil record that seemed to show like, hey, at all these geological boundaries that we're drawing, saying that, you know, like something changes here, we're going to like decide to call this the end of the Cretaceous, and we're going to call this the Paleogene above it. But there are species disappearing very suddenly. It allowed for the discovery of mass extinctions, whereas before we knew, you know, obviously creatures came and went and stuff, but these massive events where you had like more than 50% of known species disappearing, or species disappearing far faster than new ones are evolving. It took that sort of, to get those big picture views, it took that computing power to see it. And since then, that was really based upon marine organisms. It didn't really involve dinosaurs at all. It involved things like clams, these little things called forams, like an armored amoeba. And they're still present in our oceans, or algae that form these little calcified discs called coccoliths. It was studying their patterns to say, okay, there's something going on here. And then when we look to other groups of organisms, saying, okay, yeah, a lot of them are disappearing at the same time. And that story starts to emerge and come together, and you start to get a count of who makes it through and who doesn't. And for the KPG, it's really Western North America so far that's been the most important, because you have a continuous record through the end of the Cretaceous going through the beginning of the Paleogene. So you have the before and after snapshots across that boundary, whereas in most other parts of the world, you only get one or the other. And there are a few other locations where we can get this view, but it's really kind of trying to understand a global perspective through this pinhole, basically the small, relatively small area in the Montana and Dakotas that give us like the best picture of who made it through and who didn't, and to get an idea of why that happened.
You're listening to Locus Focus on KPFM Radio in Portland, Oregon, Seattle stations KBFG, LPFM, and KODX, LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, Oregon, KCEI in Taos, New Mexico, Radio Free Moscow in Idaho, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with science writer Riley Black, author of The Last Days of the Dinosaurs. Well, you told us how the impact affected life on terrestrial ground. But what about in the ocean? How were the oceans affected by this?
So the immediate effects probably weren't all that severe. It would have been for things like seabirds, that they, you know, they live on the surface, you know, unless they have some shelter to get into. There's not really a great way for them to hide from this. But if you're under the water, that heat pulse for the first day, really, was not going to be all that severe. But the impact winter that followed was absolutely devastating. That is part of the story, that you basically have all these sulfur-based compounds from the, what we call the target rock, this limestone, this remnant of ancient reefs that became fossils even before the end of the age of dinosaurs. When the asteroid hit it, it released all these sulfur-bearing compounds into the atmosphere. And we know from modern studies that these compounds are really good at reflecting sunlight back out from our atmosphere. So, you know, it cut the incoming sunlight by about 20% or so, which is pretty significant. It was enough to significantly curtail, if not entirely halt, photosynthesis over much of the planet for about 3 years. So what is the ocean ecosystem based on? It's photosynthesis. It's algae. It's, you know, phytoplankton, all these little things that, you know, photosynthesize. They provide food for like the little things that eat them and so on and so forth, all the way up the food chain. So it's kind of pulling the rug out from underneath the entire ocean ecosystem. There's a paper that came out in the past year or so about those little coccoliths that I mentioned, these little algae. All the photosynthesizing ones disappear. It's the ones that are what we call mixotrophs. They're able to both photosynthesize and eat organic debris, kind of, you know, these algae that were able to like basically hunt for and feed these little scraps of organic matter in the oceans. And they're the ones that hung on and survived and proliferated in the aftermath and kind of reformed the foundation of the oceans. So if they hadn't just by happenstance been able to survive on foods that didn't require photosynthesis, then the oceans probably would have gone back to a single-celled state. Basically, like 500 million years of evolutionary history would have been totally wiped out in the oceans. So it was as close as the seas probably got to just like a total ecosystem collapse, that once you remove that ability to photosynthesize, it becomes very difficult to survive.
Well, how did the birds survive?
Yeah, so we have dinosaurs with us, right? And we have beaked birds. There were, prior to the impact, birds with beaks, there were birds with teeth, and there were very bird-like raptor dinosaurs. So things like Velociraptor that you know, see in the films, but covered in feathers and very bird-like in their behaviors. And there was a study that came out a few years ago, so okay, why is it that the beaked birds survive while these very bird-like raptors go extinct and the toothed birds go extinct? And it seemed to be teeth made the difference. And that's because if you had teeth, chances are you were a predator. You were either hunting insects or little mammals or lizards or whatever it was. And that's exactly what's in short supply after the impact and after that heat pulse and the impact winter. It's very difficult to find food if you're a carnivore, if you rely on other organisms to eat. But beaked birds had already evolved to survive on seeds and nuts and basically things that were in the seed bank, in the soil, that were protected during all these catastrophic events. So they still had a food source, and they're able to survive because their bodies, not just their beaks, but they had gizzards and ways to break down nuts and seeds in their digestive systems. So they were able to hang on because of that, and those survivors then proliferated. So this is another case of just like the variety of life when you have enough organisms doing different things under extreme circumstances. Some are just going to luck out and have those traits required really to make it through these catastrophic times. So in this case, it was because just some birds had already evolved to eat foods that were resilient and weren't going to really go anywhere during this crisis. And they were able to make it through that period of just a couple years.
But how did the birds get through the heat pulse?
Right. So there are a lot of ways to sort of get around that heat pulse if you are able to get underground, underwater. And we know from the fossil record that many different organisms in the past, just like today, burrowed. So you had mammals that created burrows, you had crocodilians that made burrows, you had tortoises that did, some birds as well. So even if you didn't make a burrow yourself, you know, it's pretty common that, you know, there'll be abandoned burrows that organisms will find later and shelter in. So it's most likely that whatever small critters survive, and they're almost all small, that's one of the things, that there's like a size filter on this, where nothing, you know, really bigger than about a house cat or so, you know, makes it through unless you're underwater somewhere. But for the beaked birds, so far as we can tell, they likely were able to basically either borrow one of these pre-existing burrows or just find some shelter beneath the soil in just enough numbers to make it through on the other side.
I want to have another movie reference for a moment, because as I was reading your book, I kept flashing on that movie, Don't Look Up, and the end when the comet hits the Earth. Mm. And I, when I saw the movie, I thought, well, this is really an exaggeration. It's kind of crazy with the ocean spilling and ocean creatures, you know, winding up on the land and stuff. I'm just wondering if you have a sense that things could have been as dramatic in that film in actually what happened.
Yeah, I think it depends on where you were on the Earth at that time. If you were in, you know, relatively far from the impact, like in the book, you know, I center this on Hell Creek, Montana, the formation in that part of the world. And, you know, the impact is so quickly that it probably wasn't like those images that we usually see associated with news reports about new studies about the extinction, where you have like a T-Rex that's watching a comet kind of streak across the sky. This is moving so quickly that there wasn't like a great, you know, sort of, there wasn't a warning. There was, you know, they weren't looking at the shooting star approaching. It was probably relatively quick. Whether or not they saw like any light or anything from the impact is, we really can't say for sure. But if you were close to the center of impact, if you were in ancient Central America, you know, Cretaceous Mexico, you would have seen the local devastation that occurred, and just like these tsunamis that were skyscraper size that emanated out from the area of impact and were so powerful that when they hit the coast, they not only washed over the coast, but they rebounded and headed back towards the crater and sort of reburied it. If you look at the geology of the crater today, you can see how it's just a mess. It's just all this kind of like kind of crumpled rock and sand, and all these things that not only went outward, but then crashed back inward. And it's thought that this impact might have been powerful enough to basically blow any dinosaurs in that area, like into basically out of our atmosphere, like slightly into space. That hasn't been verified. No one has found a dinosaur out there. It's very unlikely that it's ever going to happen. But just the amount of energy that this released, you know, it's kind of like children's numbers. You know, you might as well say that it was just like a zillion, you know, newtons or whatever of explosive force. That this impact created. It was really like unlike anything else. So it's something where I feel like as sort of, as strange as it might seem, like movies like Don't Look Up, like that ending, or, you know, Armageddon or Deep Impact or anything else, in some ways they probably undersell how strange and catastrophic the effects of these impacts were.
Well, let's jump ahead 100 years. And what was life like on the planet 100 years after impact?
Yeah. So one of the things I tried to do in the book was really walk readers through the time scale, right? Starting with, you know, the moment of impact on the first day, week and month and year, and take these little snippets about what's going on. And 100 years after impact, it's difficult to tell because we know that, you know, certain species would have totally disappeared by then and some would have survived, but life had not yet recovered. So 100 years, a century after the impact, you know, the impact winter is over, but life has still not recovered. You wouldn't have seen anything big on that landscape. You know, mammals, the largest ones were about the size of a badger. Most surviving animals were relatively small. Plants hadn't really started to really thrive in the aftermath yet. So you wouldn't have seen like big forests per se, but you would have seen a lot of ferns. Ferns are what we call disaster taxon in that they tend to show up and do well and environments have been recently disturbed. So like after a big volcanic eruption, things like ferns that kind of are the first to sort of reseed and grow in those sorts of areas. So it would have seemed like a fundamentally different world from the one at the end of the Cretaceous, where just like everything is small, everything is kind of under the cover of these ferns that are just starting to go back. And it's like, it's the beginnings. It's like, if you think about like springtime and you start to look for those little green shoots that are just starting to come up, it was sort of the Paleogene equivalent of that, just the very beginnings of the pressure being off and life starting to come back again.
And so let's jump ahead 100,000 years. What's happening now?
Yeah, so 100,000 years, that's like the peak time of what we call the fern spike. So even though they had started to grow back, like at this point, like from what we know from the pollen fossil record, that just like ferns were everywhere and forests were starting to come back again. And they're growing in a different way. When you think about what dinosaurs did on the landscape, they often, much like big herbivores today, they knocked over trees, they trampled down game paths, they, you know, left their dung everywhere, they ate certain plants and ignored others. So they really shaped the landscape around themselves. And a dinosaur populated landscape is going to have big spaces. And if you think of sort of like the East African savanna today, the past wasn't quite like that. You know, grasses hadn't really proliferated yet. You didn't have big grasslands. But that idea of you'd have like stands of trees and big spaces in between them, that was sort of a dinosaur landscape. But in the Paleogene, 100,000 years after impact, you're starting to have these forests that grow much more closely together. They're much denser. And this really becomes a crucible for evolution, because now when you think about like a thick forest like that, you have the canopy level, and then you have the trunks of the trees and those different sort of strata along those trunks, and then, you know, the surface of the soil and even under the soil. So in the same square mile of habitat, you kind of have a lot more habitat to work with, in a sense, because it is so dense, and all sorts of creatures can start to evolve in different ways. Like, as there's competition for resources, you have mammals that can start to become specialized on digging or climbing that bark or living in the canopy or doing something different. So it seems that biodiversity is often tied to conditions like this, where like when you have these dense forests, it allows a lot more species to evolve in that space than one that's really spread out, as it was at the end of the Cretaceous. So you're just seeing the beginnings of that, where, you know, mammals are still relatively small. They're still mostly the survivors that are left over from the Cretaceous, but they're in this landscape where they can really start to adapt and evolve in new ways.
Well, you mentioned in the book about how dinosaurs really, the size and breadth of dinosaur species made it pretty impossible for mammals to really evolve in any major way. And the dinosaurs definitely dominated the landscape for, what, 165 million years that they were around. I wonder if you can compare that to what humans are doing now, and maybe have this be a lesson for us about what happens when you dominate the landscape.
Yeah, I find that interesting. In our discussions of dinosaurs, we often go to this term of dominance, right? But like when we think about ecologically, what does that mean? And that they were prominent and they were widespread, but you know, they're also just animals. Like they're evolving in their own particular way. And mammals actually, they diversified under the feet of dinosaurs. So even though they didn't get very big, there were mammals that were the ancient equivalents of beavers and otters and raccoons and aardvarks and flying squirrels and things like that. So they were changing quite a bit. They just had to be relatively small, because if you got too big, it's easy to pick you off. It's easy for those mammals to become prey. And I think that's one of the greatest lessons I think thinking about now, is that it's not always about sort of what the biggest animal is or is doing. It's all these different forms of life that are interconnected at smaller scales that are sometimes easy to overlook, that can be environmental indicators of how well a habitat is doing. Like I know amphibians today, like they might not always be the most charismatic or the prominent animals in the habitat, but if you want to know how a landscape is doing or an environment is doing, you look to the frogs and salamanders and things and look and see how their populations are doing. Similarly with small mammals, that their health is kind of a reflection of what that ecosystem is doing. So I feel like whether it was 66 million years ago or now, if you really want to get a sense of, okay, how is life responding to these changes, looking at the small creatures that you know, we might think of as kind of in the background are really the best way to get a sense of, okay, like what is happening and how quickly is it happening?
Well, you're listening to Locust Focus on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Oregon, Seattle stations KBFG, LPFM, and KODX, LPFM. KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, Oregon, KCEI in Taos, New Mexico, Radio Free Moscow in Idaho, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with science writer Riley Black, author of The Last Days of the Dinosaurs. Getting back to the whole range of extinctions, I guess there's been a lot of talk in the last number of years about we're facing the sixth extinction, that there's already major extinctions going on. And I wonder what lessons we can draw from the fifth extinction to look at what we're doing, and if there's any way that we can pull back from completely creating an equivalent demise.
Yeah, I think a lot of it is looking at like what conditions are we creating and which species are going to be most vulnerable. But it's also, I think, important to look at things that, let me put it this way. There are a number of things that are showing up that we didn't entirely expect about a number of species. So we're starting to learn that, for example, like you may have heard of the vaquita. So that's one of the, you know, creatures that's really threatened right now. You have a very small population of these small whales. And they've been a conservation priority for a very long time as well. They should be, but we're finding out that they have much more genetic diversity or flexibility, at least, than we previously thought, so that there's a potential for them to still create viable populations, like without sort of the damage that inbreeding can cause when you get small populations. And this has happened before. If you think of southern elephant seals, they were almost entirely eradicated. They're actually thought to be extinct, and now they're incredibly common. So from the bare minimum of individuals, they're able to recover and come back. And I think sometimes with the fifth mass extinction, we get very hung up on the loss of the dinosaurs, the species that went extinct. But we're really just now learning about what allowed the species that survived to make it through. And that's still very incompletely known. We have a few ideas about that. But I think it's teaching us about when you have these sweeping changes to ecosystems, what are the sort of fail-safe habitats? What are the sorts of things that then help generate more biodiversity? And I think that's an important part of the story. It's not just how do we prevent loss, but how do we create conditions for species to proliferate and continue to evolve, these refuges that we can find or make in some way or another. And I think that's certainly, you know, even just in broad strokes, that's an important thing to remember, is not just how do we prevent loss, but how do we foster new growth?
Well, about 8 years ago, I saw John Stewart interviewing Elizabeth Colbert right after she wrote The Sixth Extinction. And John Stewart said to her, "Well, we're the asteroid." And after reading your book, I realized, well, we're not really the asteroid, but I wonder if there's any analogy there that resonates for you.
Yeah, in a sense, we can view ourselves as the asteroid. Like, we are certainly causing, you know, the damage in this case, and we need to own it because it's the first step to doing anything about it. But that's the big difference, is that, you know, the asteroid, it came from, you know, the outer reaches of our solar system. It was actually a very old piece of our solar system that just didn't get taken up into a planet, and just by happenstance got shot, you know, into the center of our solar system. It was basically on its way while the dinosaurs were evolving and stuff. So their fate, in a sense, was almost sealed just by, you know, the laws of physics and mathematics, all the while they're evolving on our planet. In our case, we can decide to change course. We can decide to miss. And that's, I think, the frustrating part of it, you know, to bring it back to, you know, what you mentioned at the top of our conversation, that I know the way that I feel, whether it's about global climate change, Roe being overturned, you know, attacks on transgender people, all these things that are just these big, terrible events, and we all want to do something about them. And I think the organizations, institutions, and people who have the most power to change that aren't, or at least don't seem to have the will to do it. And then how do we change it? I think that's the metaphor that I find right now. It's like, in a sense, that, you know, many of us, we want to change the path of the asteroid, but how do you change the trajectory of something that feels so massive? And I don't necessarily have an answer for that. But I think it's important to remember that, like, this is actually our opportunity, that if we feel like we are this asteroid that's just hurtling toward this terrible outcome, what is it that we can do to try and change its course before it hits anything too significant?
Well, one of the really emotional moments in your book is thinking about how we would not exist today if the dinosaurs had not gone extinct, and yet you feel this incredible connection to dinosaurs and really wish that you could be living with them. Let's talk a little bit about that juxtaposition.
Yeah, it's something that I think as a kid, you know, it's hard not to become attached to the dinosaurs. You know, they're often anthropomorphized in some way. You know, they're just so prominent that we don't just meet them as these objects of scientific curiosity. They're our friends, in the sense that we want to ride a brontosaurus to school or have a pet tyrannosaurus that we can feed in the big dog bowl or whatever it is. And I think some remnant of that, certainly for me, has stuck with me. But I knew that it's certainly clear that if that asteroid hadn't hit in the way that it did, and not even dinosaurs survived, that we wouldn't be here. Evolution would have been, you know, irrevocably altered in a different timeline, basically would have opened from that event. But I think what gives me solace in that is, even though that we're gone, we can still touch them. We can still have our conversations, one-sided as they might be, with their fossils, with, you know, wonder about them. And each year, you know, every week, really, we're learning something new. We're learning a little bit more about them. It's this sort of spirit of sort of warm conversation between us and the past that helps us reflect on, you know, who we are and how we got here. And yeah, as much as I miss the dinosaurs, or at least, you know, feel like I missed my opportunity to, you know, really get acquainted with them or see them as I would like to, it is still thrilling and it is still wonderful to, you know, get my boots on, get my backpack on, take a sip of water and walk out into the desert and go looking for them and see if they're still there and meet them where they are now and think about what that means for the history of life on Earth, for the context of whether it's my own life or humanity as a whole. And I'm glad, at least in that respect, that they're still here.
Well, you mentioned at the end of the book, you make an analogy between the shedding of one reality, one epoch, and the rebirth of a known. And you talk about it in terms of your own life. And I wonder if you just wanted to talk a little bit about that to close our show out.
Yeah, I was thinking about what book to write next. So I finished a book called Skeleton Keys about our own skeletons and their natural history. I was thinking about what to do next. And this idea about this extinction was on my mind because I realized I had never really talked about it fully. I kind of yada yada it. So, you know, big rock hits the earth, extinction must have happened. That's not the whole story. And around that time, I found out that I was getting divorced. I had also just come out as transgender, and my life felt like it very quickly fundamentally shifted, that I had been kind of moving along this particular path for, you know, about 35 years, you know, trying to do what everybody else wanted me to do and set a role that didn't fit for me. And then very quickly, life felt very different. And it felt like a violent change. It felt like a catastrophic change. There was a sense of grief and loss and difficulty. But I knew that basically the life that I had been trying to live had to end in order to flourish, to thrive, to, you know, actually live the life that I had always wanted to. And there wasn't really another way about it. So I related very directly to this particular mass extinction because this wasn't something that happened over a long period of time and required all these little changes and adjustments and stuff. It was something that happened so quickly and so violently. And yet I was amazed looking at, you know, the Paleogene of the past 66 million years and seeing how wonderfully life bounced back. And at least at that level, I really related to that. Like, you know, we can miss, you know, a certain era that, you know, played out in a particular way, either in our lives or in past history. But, you know, endings can also be beginnings. And this sort of inflection point of one great age ending and another beginning and life still finding a way to kind of burst forth in this new and different way, it spoke to me very personally. And I knew I had to write this story. And I feel like you can read the book and certainly get lots of information about dinosaurs and the extinction, fossil record, and ecology, and that sort of stuff. But I feel like understanding where that comes from, that for me, this is a very personal story, in a sense, about grief and loss and recovery and resilience. It adds a different filter to it. And I hope that, you know, for anybody who knows what those feelings are like, that resonates.
Well, Raleigh, it's wonderful to talk to you, and I really enjoyed your book a lot, and I look forward to the next one. So thanks a lot for being on Locus Focus.
Oh, thank you so much. It's been wonderful to be here.
We've been talking with science writer Raleigh Black, author of The Last Days of the Dinosaurs, and you've been listening to Locus Focus on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Oregon, Seattle stations KBFG, LPFM, Cody XO, LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, Oregon, KCEI in Taos, New Mexico, Radio Free Moscow in Idaho, and Radio Tacoma. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed or you want your friends or family to hear this show, you can listen to a podcast on our website, kboo.fm/locus-focus. To hear previous episodes of the show or any of our KBOO public affairs programming, go to kboo.fm or listen on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. I want to give special thanks to the KBOO staff who are doing an incredible job of not only keeping KBOO on the air, but helping all us volunteers make the best radio possible during this pandemic. And you can help us if you're able by becoming a member of KBOO or renewing your membership if you're already a member. We're independent, community-supported, volunteer-powered radio. Go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Or please support the community station you're listening to right now. Thanks for supporting community-powered radio. I'm Barbara Bernstein. Next week, Eric DePlace with the Ohio River Valley Institute will give a mini-course on Hydrogen 101. We'll go out with music by the Neville Brothers. Thanks for listening. Stay safe, get your COVID shots, and remember to socially distance and wear a mask when necessary.
was born by the river in a little tent. Oh, and just like the river I've been running ever since. Oh, it's been a long time coming, but I know change gonna come. Oh, yes it will. It's been too hard living, but I'm afraid to die, 'cause I don't know what's up there beyond the sky. Oh, it's been a long, long time coming, but I know brother, help me please. But he winds up knocking me. Right down on my knees. Oh, there's been times that I thought I couldn't last for long, but now I think I'm able to carry on. Oh, it's been a long, long time coming, but I know a change gonna come. Yes, it will. I know.